Welcome to Tarity Macha, Nafiomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rena Foreman, and today we will be studying Yecheskel, Perek Mem Aleph, Chapter 41. The last parak gave us a vision of an angelic figure with a ledger at his waist and a measuring tape in his hand. This mysterious figure shows the Navi Yecheskel aspects of the third and final Beit HaMikdash. He does so with the use of his petil pishtan, his string of flax, which he seems to use to measure just about everything he can. The details of this Mikdash in our psukim are many, almost dizzying, and hard to decipher. Reading the prakim with the multitude of details they contain, you begin to wonder if you really are meant to make sense of what is happening here. There are many measurements listed, yes, but there are also key details missing, height and width without the depth, for example, and there are many esoteric details whose meaning is not immediately clear. Even Rashi and Radak basically throw up their hands at certain points and say they have no idea what is going on here. Other Mefarshim seem to consider these details so hard to decipher that they simply close out their commentary on Yecheskel a few prakim early, before these Beit HaMikdash prakim. Rav Yeshaya Ritrani aptly says, Midot habayit v'seder hakorbanot v'mishpat hakohanim ha'amurim kan ein adam ba'olam sheyuchal la'amod al mititam. The measurements of the bayit and the laws of the offerings and priests that are spoken about here, there is no person in the world who can get to the truth of this. The difficulty in deciphering these prakim is borne out by a statement of the Rambam that Ezra and his cohort, despite their hope to use Sefer Yecheskel as a guide in the building of Bayit Sheni, were not able to. Ultimately, they resorted to building the second Bayit, basically in the image of the first Bayit instead. Rambam in Hilchot Beit HaBechira tells us further, Binyan shebana Shlomo kfar mefarash mimelachim, v'habinyan ha'atid libanot, af al pi shehu katuv b'Yecheskel, eino mefarash umuvo'ar. Even though the building of the Bayit that will be built in the future is written about in the book of Yecheskel, it is not really explained or elucidated there. So it's worth asking, if Yecheskel's guide in our Sefer doesn't explain or elucidate, what then is the point of all this detail? Is it possible that we aren't really supposed to understand? If so, why burden us with so many psukim full of trivia? Well, the truth is that detail, almost laborious detail, that is actually nothing new in our Sefer. By now, we are familiar with Yecheskel's propensity for relaying details. We have seen it in the plethora of detail, almost stream of consciousness description of the Merkava, the chariot in Perek Aleph. And as a matter of fact, isn't it interesting that the vision of the chariot at the very beginning of the book is laden with all these details, and so is the vision of the final Mikdash at the very end of the book? These two visions seem to be kind of like bookends, mirror images of one another, the portable place for Hashem in heaven during times of exile, and the permanent place for Hashem on earth when Israel merits to return to the land, each with so much detail, and yet each mysterious and inscrutable, despite all the detail. Which brings me to a theory. This might seem radical, but maybe the details are not meant to be understood. Maybe all this was never meant to be a blueprint. After all, consider the details of the vision of the chariot. Were those blueprints? What were we humans expected to build out of those? And, just hear me out for a moment, let's say the Navi was really looking to create a template for building the Mikdash. Don't you think he was capable of putting together blueprints that weren't missing key pieces of information? Instructions that were at least relatively easy to follow? If IKEA can do it, well, I guess even IKEA has its problems, but if IKEA can more or less do it, why couldn't Yecheskel? As a matter of fact, we actually have a precedent in the Torah for blueprints that actually worked. Back in Sefer Shmot, in Parsha Truma, the details there were written out clearly and took the form of explicit commands. So why not follow that model? Is this third Mikdash so much more complex than the Mikdash that the author of the Torah was flummoxed and just did the best he could? Of course not. Heaven forbid. If you look carefully at these prakim in Yecheskel, you'll notice that the Navi actually is never really commanded to build the Mikdash. It's not like he's the new Bezalel from back in Shmo. No, our Navi merely gets glimpses, sideways glances, of a heavenly scene. He follows around this angelic man with a patil pishtan, going through a dizzying labyrinth of chambers and rooms, watching him measure everything carefully. I would like to suggest that perhaps when we approach this section of Yechezkel, we might just be misunderstanding the genre of the book, which would be akin to studying a poetry book as though it were an organic chemistry textbook. Of course it doesn't add up to be a complete amino acid. It was never meant to. Maybe the prakim at the end of our sefer, with all those details, were not meant to be a halachic blueprint. Maybe they were meant to be a mysterious vision with all sorts of allegorical meaning, just like the Merkava vision was in the beginning of the sefer. The Merkava was a detailed vision of God's mobile home. This description of the temple at the other end of the book is a detailed vision of Hashem's permanent home, bookends as it were, neither of which is meant to tell you how to build them. But that doesn't mean we are meant to ignore these details either. In fact, paying attention to the sheer volume of detail actually shapes our experience. I would posit that it can even help us understand what the Navi is trying to get at. Because seeing the minutiae, it contributes to the sense of realism in the vision. In other words, even though this vision will take place many, many years in the future, the overwhelming, voluminous detail leaves a powerful impression. It makes clear that it is real and concrete, and not just a fable, kind of like the detail in the vision of the Merkava itself, back in the beginning of our sefer. Even though what Yechezkel had seen was often the heavens, the detail gave it a sense of realism, a sense that this can't be ignored. And maybe that explains the preponderance of a certain couple of words in these prakim. Listen to this from Parak Mem. Vayamad et rochav habinyan, kana achad v'koma kana. Vayamad et saf ha-sha'ar, kana achad rochav v'et saf achad. Vayamad et al ulam ha-sha'ar, mehabayit kana achad. And this theme continues in Parak Mem Aleph. Vayivini al ha-hichal, vayamad et ha-ilim. Vayamad orko arba'im amah. Vayamad el ha-petach. Vayamad, madad. Perhaps the use of so many verbs is one more way in which God gives over the message to Yechezkel that this third permanent bayit, it is going to happen. The architect is actually on the ground, sketching it all out, carefully measuring everything. There will be a real mikdash. It is being measured out precisely. With this background, let's look at some of the psukim in these prakim. And as we do, let's watch for some repetitive language to further shape our understanding. Berochav hatzela arbam amo saviv saviv, labayit saviv. Vatzlaot tzela al tzela shalosh shloshim pa'amim. Uva'ot bakir asher labayit letzlaot saviv saviv liot achuzim. V'lo yu achuzim bakir habayit. Rachava v'nasaba lamala lamala letzlaot. Ki musav habayit lamala lamala saviv saviv labayit. Get the idea. Well, saviv saviv, around and around, that phrase keeps on appearing at almost every possible juncture. If you keep on reading the psukim, you'll keep on hearing it. The words seem to take on an alliterative quality. Now keep in mind, this word savav, samach beiz veiz, well, in the original vision of God's Merkava, his temporary dwelling from the first parak of the book, we do find something that plays off these savav words specifically. Let's go back to parak Aleph and just listen to Yechezkel describe the heavenly chariot that he sees. Lo yisabu belachdam, ish el ever panav yelechu. El asher yashama haruach lelechet yelechu, lo yisabu belachdam. Al arbat rivehem belachdam yelechu, lo yisabu belachdam. There is savav over and over in this mobile mikdash. The chayot don't turn. Lo yisav. Seemingly, these chayot, they have many faces, panim, so the chayot won't need to turn. All this is very mystical. The meaning is not something we can really understand, but one thing does seem clear. It seems that the contrast between these two bookend visions is deliberate and striking. We are meant to notice it. There is a difference between the temporary heavenly chariot version of God's place and the permanent earthly version of God's house. But exactly what and why? That is left to the realm of the mystical. We don't really know. As we continue reading the psukim, we learn that every part of the mikdash structure in the Perek was covered with wood and would then be covered with gold. As we turn to the design on these wooden panels, we hear of images that we have encountered before. Va'asui kruvim utmorim utmora bein kruv lakruv, ushnai panim lakruv. So a palm tree between the kruvim, and each kruv had two faces. Ufnei adam al hatmora mipo, ufnei kfir al hatmora mipo, lion on one side and a human image on the other. Asui al kol habayit saviv saviv, meha'aretz ad me'al hapetach hakruvim v'hatmorim asuyim. The walls, the doors, were made out of kruvim utmorim. The kruvim get emphasized in these psukim. Yes, as part of the design, the kruvim are back. The same creatures that appeared in Hashem's mobile home, the chariot, the merkava, back in the beginning of the sefer. And later, Yechezkel comes to the realization that these kruvim were chayot. In other words, that these heavenly beings were alive. For example, in Perek Yud, when he sees the kruvim flying heavenward as they leave Yerushalayim, he even remarks, "Hi ha-chaya asher ra'iti al Nahar Kvar." This was the chaya that I saw back in Nahar Kvar in the beginning in Perek Aleph. But now in our psukim, here in the Mikdash, God's permanent home, the kruvim are stationary. They are lifeless again, mirror drawings ensconced in the design of the wall panels. It's mysterious. And this time, these kruvim, they are paired with something else. You may have noticed another word that made its way into those psukim that we read multiple times. Tmorim, palm trees. Meha'aretz ad me'al hapetach hakruvim v'hatmorim asuyin. The design that incorporated palm trees and kruvim went all the way up the wall, floor to ceiling. And later we hear, V'asuya aleihem el datot ha'echal kruvim utmorim ka'asher asuyim lakirot. Even the doors in the ulam were made of a design that included this duo, kruvim and tmorim, cherubs and palm trees. We have seen that combination before, right? Kruvim and trees. That combination takes us all the way back to Gan Eden itself. In the garden, there were many trees, and when man was expelled from the garden, God set up kruvim, placed at its entrance, to protect God's special tree. In the words of Bereishit, lishmor et derech etz hachayim. So here, in the temple in the Beit HaMikdash, painted between each angel is a date tree. Seemingly, the kruvim are guarding those trees, just like they were back in the garden. We will come back to these kruvim and their function in another parak or two, where Yechezkel will give us an even clearer idea of their meaning. But there is something more in that nearly last pasuk in our parak, something else that adds another element of mystery to the picture. In addition to all of this, Ve'av eitz el pnei ha'ulam mehachutz, there was a thick piece of wood facing the ulam on the periphery, an av eitz. What does that remind you of back in Chumash? It actually reminds us of one of the Moadim, a holiday. Here is the pasuk in Sefer Vayikra, where we encounter that unusual phrase. Ulekachtem lachem b'yom harishon, pri etz hadar kapot shmarim, v'anaf etz avot, v'arvei nachal, usmachtem lifnei Hashem elokechem, shiv'at yamim. Remarkably, the pasuk which talks about the Arba Minim on Sukkot, it doesn't just mention an Av Eitz. It also mentions Tmorim, palm trees, the image we were just discussing that appeared in the third Mikdash next to those Kruvim. Lokachtem lachem b'yom harishon pri Eitz hadar kapot Tmorim. The Av Eitz and kapot Tmorim that we are seeing images of in the Mikdash, the text seems to suggest that they are on some level representations of the Arba Minim, the four species of plants that we bring together on the holiday of Sukkot. Well, if Sukkot is meant to shape our thinking in reference to the Mikdash, that might shed light on the preponderance of the phrase Saviv Saviv in our psukim that we mentioned earlier. Because going around and around, well, that too is a Sukkot idea. On Sukkot, we encircle the bima, the ark, as we shake the Arba Minim, as we say Hoshanot. And those encirclements they go all the way back to the days of the Mikdash. And if somehow Sukkot and the Mikdash are a pair, then the Pasuk we referenced earlier, that Pasuk from the end of Zechariah, which talks about the third Bayit, comes into relief. Vaya kohanotar b'kol ha-goyim ha-ba'im al Yerushalayim v'alu midei shana b'shana l'hishachavot l'melech Hashem Tzvakot v'lachog et chag ha-Sukkot. And it will be that the survivors from among the nations that had formerly attacked Israel, those nations remaining after the War of Gog, they are to come to the Mikdash to worship God, to bow and celebrate Sukkot, along with Jews of the land of Israel. The Pasuk in Zechariah specifically mentions Sukkot when it discusses the joint celebration of Jews and Gentiles at the time of the Third Temple. Moreover, Shlomo inaugurated the first Mikdash at the time of Sukkot. What is it about Sukkot and the Mikdash that make them go together? It doesn't seem coincidental. There must be something going on here. The key is to start thinking about the Mikdash for what it really is, a home for God in our world. There is something about God's home that is meant to parallel a Sukkah. Think about this. Isn't it interesting that the English name for the holiday of Sukkot is the Feast of Tabernacles? The tabernacle, of course, is one of the English words for the Mishkan. But look it up in the dictionary and you will find that a tabernacle is a temporary dwelling. In the desert, we had a Mishkan, a temporary dwelling for Hashem, and in the desert, Hashem put us in temporary houses, Sukkot. So it makes sense that he asked us to make a temporary house for him. And that, of course, took the form of the Mishkan. Seems that our home and God's home, maybe they're supposed to match. And maybe we now understand why King David was suddenly so eager to build a house for God, a Beit HaMikdash. This feeling that God needed a house coincided with David's building of his own palace. His words to Natan HaNavi at the time reflect this. Re'ena anochi yoshev beveit arazim v'aron ha'elokim yoshev betoch ha'iria. David says, how can I dwell in a permanent house when God is just in a temporary house? God tells him that it's not the time yet, because I, God, have not yet finished building your real house, your legacy, the Malchut. It needs to transfer peacefully to your son before your house is complete, and then you can build me my permanent house. But you see from all this that David's logic was on the money. God's home should match our own. So once God sets us up in a permanent house, sets us up for good in the land of Israel, it falls up to us to make him a permanent house, a Mikdash. And maybe that's why there's so much detail in our Prakim, which relate to this house of Hashem that is to be erected. These details, maybe they help us concretize the fact that this third Bayit, this thing is permanent, this thing is for real. Because after this last war to end all wars, God has to put us back in our own house in Israel in a permanent way. So getting back to Sukkot, it's not a coincidence that the imagery in the Mikdash should evoke the holiday of Sukkot. Those Sukkot God placed us in when we were in the wilderness and our corresponding obligation to make a Mishkan for him, that was the beginning of the idea that God should have a house just like ours. Now, centuries later in history, we're completing the idea. We are making a different kind of house for Hashem, a permanent one, that is just like ours. And even as we do so, we let our permanent house bear the memory of the original houses, temporary ones, that we occupied in the desert. The sense of permanence that comes along with this Mikdash, it provides us with stability. We can rely on the fact that Hashem is there for us, in his permanent home, waiting for us. When we left Mitzrayim, we were just in a temporary abode, and so we made a temporary place for God. But now that we are in our land permanently at the end of days, now it falls upon us to match that permanence with an everlasting home for Hashem, the third and final Bayit, B'mehera B'yameinu. Thank you for studying together, L'Ilui Nishmat Riva Schwab, Rivka Bat Alexander Sender.